Welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast, coming to you from San Luis Obispo, California.
Where you stand?
LA living gridlocked in the fast lane. Trying to strike a rich match, play my cash game.
Welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast. I am in the company, it's Owen here, of course. I'm in the company of greatness today, really and truly. Cal Poly royalty, a recent inductee into the Cal Poly Athletics Hall of Fame. She's, and I wrote this down because I wanted to get all of it. It's a lot of stuff, Sharon. A lot of accolades, a lot of awards. She's a 2005 NCAA National High Jump Champion. She jumped 6'4", I think. In the NCAAs. Have you jumped higher than that since then?
I have. 3/4 of an inch higher.
3/4 of an inch higher. What? 3 times a Big West high jump champion in the conference. She was also a long jump and heptathlon champion. 2-time Cal Poly Female Student Athlete of the Year. Your freshman year and your senior year?
Yep. My sophomore year and my senior year.
Okay, which is kind of random in terms of like timing of it, but that's just how it goes sometimes, I think. Importantly, a 2-time Olympian, 3-time world championship competitor. The winningest, this is something that was on the Cal Poly Hall of Fame thing, so I had to get it. The winningest multi-event athlete in U.S. history, 3 outdoor heptathlon and 4 consecutive indoor pentathlon titles. And it just so happens that on the women's soccer team, she's number 5 all time in points. Sharon Day Monroe, thanks for coming to the podcast today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm going to turn you up a little bit here so that I can make sure I'm hearing you. You're 5'9", but can you dunk?
I've never actually tried to dunk a basketball. I can touch the rim, though.
Oh, I'm sure you can. So. you can put your whole body over 6'4", so like, I'd imagine you could probably touch the rim.
Yeah.
And probably get up high enough. Dunk of like anything you can palm, probably.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. If I could palm it, I probably could.
Nobody's ever been like, Sharon, come on, let's go. Let's see if you can do it.
Oh, there's been plenty of times where like people have asked.
That's totally the bro question, though. Like, I'm sorry.
I've never actually done it, though.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. That's the story. How'd you end up in SLO at Cal Poly? You're from Orange County originally, right?
I am. Yep. I grew up in Southern California. Yeah. My family's originally from New York. I was actually born in Brooklyn. Okay. And then we moved to Southern California when I was very young, but went through elementary and high school there. Cal Poly, actually, I hadn't really heard of it until I was being recruited by the former coach here at the time.
Who was that?
Sheldon Blockberger was the jumps coach, and Terry Crawford was the director of track and field and cross country.
Okay, so you recruited by, that was a question I was going to ask. You recruited by the track program?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I knew that I wanted to stay in California. I knew that I wanted to go to a school with a good education. And then as it turned out, I wasn't ready to let soccer go yet. So that was definitely the kind of selling point for Cal Poly is when I came on a recruiting trip, I had a conversation with Alex Crozier about continuing to play soccer. He ended up coming and watching me play a high school match and basically told me if I came to Cal Poly, I'd have a spot on the team. So that was definitely the biggest kind of deciding factor that I would be able to do both.
So it's kind of interesting, you know, you got recruited as a kind of a track athlete, a sprinter and a high jumper, which is, you know, technically kind of multi-event at least.
Yeah.
But then also multi-sport in terms of soccer. And that was a big factor for you.
Definitely.
Terms of
coming here. Yeah.
Yeah. What was that conversation like with Alex before he had seen you play?
I just remember going into his office and being like, I really want to continue to play. He had no idea who I was. I think that maybe Terry had given him a heads up that, well, we have this girl we're recruiting, like, she's going to come and say hi to you.
She's probably
and
pretty I'm fast.
Sure, yeah. You know, like. I'm sure she let him know that they really wanted me on the track team. And so maybe that influenced his, like, you know, welcoming of me to try. And so he just pretty much just said, I'll come see you play and, you know, we'll see. And then he did, and so I guess he liked what he saw.
I always think that says something, like, about a coach, especially at a college level or even, like, a high level of high school, that, you know, a coach who encourages or accepts, you know, uh, with with open arms, you know, players or athletes who have other responsibilities and other commitments, I guess, you know, athletically and time-wise. And I'm sure there were times that, you know, you didn't make all the off-season soccer workouts, for example, right?
I mean, none, actually.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
So I pretty much made a deal with both coaches that if I was going to do both, it would be pretty much all of one at one time. The only really crossover I had was in the fall, toward the end of fall, I would start doing some high jump run-throughs like once a week with the coach. Otherwise, when it was soccer season, I was playing soccer. And when it was track season, I was doing track.
Right, right. And they didn't really overlap a ton,
no,
if at all, right?
Which I mean, nice. The only thing I really missed, I would say, would be spring soccer when we'd have a few exhibitions or scrimmages.
Sure.
Other than that.
It's not like, I mean, part of spring soccer is staying in shape throughout the whole year. It's not like
you work. Yeah, exactly. And I was doing that on the track, so.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. So I'm just interested because Crozier is the only women's soccer coach that Cal Poly's ever had. You know, I'm interested in with some, I don't know, perspective now, kind of what your thoughts are about him and his like acceptance of a multi-sport athlete. Because I want to talk about multi-sport athletes a little bit too in high school and other things. I'm kind of segueing there.
Well, I'm certainly thankful for the opportunity to be able to play both because there were plenty of coaches at other D1 West Coast schools that were not willing to let me even try to do both or willing to work with other coaches on their campuses to try to make that happen. So I'm certainly thankful for that. And I think that more coaches need to be a little bit more accepting of multi-sport athletes because there are a lot of athletes out there that have a lot to offer. And sometimes specializing may or may not be the best thing for a particular athlete. Yeah. And I think that when athletes are more well-rounded, they're better overall athletes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of, like I said, segueing into my questions or whatever about multi-sport athletes, especially in high school, right?
Especially in high school.
Even in high school now, I mean, I see so many, and I went to a really small high school, and, you know, it was kind of like everybody had to do everything or nobody did anything.
Yeah.
And if any of the coaches would have tried to pull some crap, like, you know, if you play football, you can't play basketball, you know, nobody would have stood for it. But at big high schools, there's so many kids who want to do so much stuff that you know they can afford to not have one of the better athletes at the school play their sport, for example.
Yeah.
Like where do you come down on that? Do you see kids like getting forced to specialize too soon nowadays?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, and I feel like it comes from a lot of different places. It could be coaches in high school, it could be their club coaches, it could be their parents, and I feel like there's so much competition nowadays to get college scholarships and to continue playing at the next level that people feel like their only option is to specialize, which I feel like that can be really detrimental to a child's development. And I feel like in a lot of sports, when you specialize and only do one thing the entire year, you're kind of missing out on some of that cross training. You're missing out on developing other muscle groups. You're missing out on developing kind of a more well-rounded, I guess I would say just kind of that athleticism and just the way your body moves and stuff. If you're only doing track and you're only high jumping, you're only taking off of one leg doing drills for that specific exercise, your body is going to create imbalances and you're going to have asymmetries. And I feel like that's going to be, in the long run, that can be really detrimental to you.
It's like an athletic education.
Exactly,
that you're almost depriving good athletes of. I mean, you know, say what you will about maybe, you know, that borderline, you know, baseball athlete who just does baseball all the time because they're not maybe as that gifted as others. Maybe that's what gets that kid over the hump on some level, which is, you know, the counter argument. But to me, you know, I see, you know, basketball teams like Michigan State basketball or, you know, places like, you know, Stanford where the, you know, kid would do wrestling and football or, mm-hmm. you know, there's certain schools that are definitely kind of known as being more open to it. And
yeah.
I think that's pretty cool that, you know, that you're able to do all that here at Cal Poly and that they were open to that. I mean, obviously they got, you know, a top five scorer in the soccer program's history and Olympian on the track, you know, in terms of, you know, the track and field side of things, I think it worked out pretty well for them.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. And for me.
and for you, right? Yeah. Right. So how did playing soccer like benefit you, mentally, physically, emotionally when you were, you know, when you did track? I mean, I would imagine track practice and, kind of the routine of track practice maybe is a little bit different being an individual thing versus versus the team camaraderie of soccer. And I feel like that would be something I'd miss, you know, I would have missed, you know, as a, like, even like a high school athlete, that like team aspect of everything.
Yeah, for sure. I think that because track and field is so individual, it's a lot more of a mental game, and having soccer as kind of a break from that, where you're not as in your head as much. And I feel like soccer is a game that's a lot more about feel. And so having that kind of mental break is definitely good. And then having the support of surrounding teammates constantly is also a great break from track and field. And I think sometimes that makes it a little more fun when you're out there with everyone else and you're not always by yourself. So I think the two are a good balance, because I operate pretty well as an individual and on my own. And I think that's why I've been pretty successful in track and field. But for anyone, having a break from kind of that, I guess, solo kind of lifestyle is always good.
To have some friends, some teammates. I mean, you have teammates on a track team, but
it's not quite the same. Yeah, because you're not in the same lane, like helping each other across the finish line. That's just not how it works.
Right. You're not attached to a bungee cord pulling them over the bar.
Yeah.
So yeah, got it. You talked about training, and you alluded to, you know, training independently and individually. I know recreational, like, triathletes who don't have lives, who have like a regular job and don't have lives, who spend, you know, crazy hours. And I guess that's more endurance than some of the stuff that's, you know, required in a pentathlon or a heptathlon or a, I don't know. I needed to brush up on my prefixes here to be able to figure it out.
You got them right.
Okay, good. Yeah. Pentathlon's five events. Which events are not in the pentathlon that are in the heptathlon?
There's no 200 meters. Excuse me. And there's no javelin.
Because you're inside.
Yeah.
You don't want to kill somebody in the crowd. Yeah. Javelin's scary.
It can be, yes.
When was the first time you threw a javelin?
My junior year at Cal Poly. So... Okay. 2007.
That's when you started doing the heptathlon.
Yes.
Okay. And what was that experience like? Because I've never thrown a javelin before.
Javelin is actually my favorite event.
Is it really now?
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. And it was one of the events that I kind of picked up pretty quickly.
Okay.
And I think that was one of the many reasons, but a big reason why my coach was so excited to turn me into a heptathlete, because the javelin and the throwing events in general are usually tough for heptathletes to pick up, and that many heptathletes struggle with.
Most start in track and high jump and
then kind of like sprinter jumpers, do their best.
Right.
Yeah. And some of the events, like even hurdles, if you're not a hurdler or a long jump, if you're not a long jumper, you can get away with doing well there if you have the speed, which a lot of girls have a background in speed.
Right. Right. And being really fast. But you picked up the javelin pretty quickly. I mean, you won Big West heptathlon championship. Was that your junior or senior year?
That was my senior year. Okay. I was second my junior year.
Okay. The first year you did it. That's nice.
Quick learner.
Yeah, exactly. So javelin's your favorite event. What's your least favorite event?
Long jump.
Really? Yeah. Why?
It's never really clicked for me. And from the beginning, a lot of people thought I'd be really good at it, having a solid background in high jump, but the events are so incredibly different.
You won the Big West Long Jump Championships once.
I did.
You think that's just because you're fast?
And I think that's part of it, but I haven't really improved since then.
Okay.
So it's been kind of a struggle these last, 7 years.
Okay. Is that frustrating?
Very frustrating, because it's the third to last event, the first event of the second day of the heptathlon. And so for me, it's kind of like my make or break event, where I can be doing really well and then not have a good long jump. And there are plenty of great longer jumpers out there that are heptathletes, and so they gain a lot of points on me there. And that's really frustrating, to kind of lose position at that point in the meet.
You were, 10th at one point in the end of the first day, and then you ended up 14th at this last one, right?
Yeah.
Was that because of the long jump? Is that part of the deal?
It was.
Yeah.
I think after long jump, I dropped down to like 23rd or something like that, and then worked my way back with the javelin and 800. So.
Okay, those are the last two.
Yeah.
The javelin and the 800.
Yep.
Yeah, the 800's got to be a weird one.
It's...
For a sprinter? I don't know. Are you like a 100, 200 kind of a sprinter?
No, I was actually more of like a 400.
Okay, so 800 wasn't horrible for you.
Yeah. And I wouldn't say that I like it or enjoy it, but it is one of my stronger events. So, but I still don't like running it.
Nobody enjoys a sprint that's too long to be a sprint.
Exactly.
Right? Or a long race that's too short to be a long race.
Yeah.
The 800's right, the right in between, kind of a weird
distance,
right? Because 400 you could kind of, you know, keep
it
up. You
can sprint all out almost, but the 800 you cannot do that. There's no way. You have to pace it, but you still have to be running pretty darn hard.
Pretty fast. Yeah. What's your best event? Like, your favorite is the javelin, but what's your best?
My best, I'd say, is probably hurdles or high jump. That's where I score the most points.
Okay.
Except high jump as of late hasn't been as good. But hurdles have been consistently getting better over the years, and I score the most points there.
Got it. And in terms of the point scoring system, because you're talking to somebody who has no idea, just like 10,000 points. Okay, cool. Is it relative to the other competitors in the field, or is it just there's a straight point score for if you can jump this high?
The second. Okay. So there's a predetermined point scale.
And on every event for distance, for time.
Yes. So based on your mark in a particular event, you get a certain score, and that scale is always the same.
That scale never changes.
That scale never changes.
So then there are some events theoretically that humans could be getting better at.
There are,
more quickly, and so those events maybe mean more too, right? In terms of getting really high.
Yeah, point totals. Definitely.
Are there some specific ones like that?
Well, I'd say that. Well, an event that's really difficult to get points in is shot put, because the scales were based on what like elite athletes were doing.
What like Stephanie can do?
Yeah, Stephanie or someone who was like a open shot put Olympian, you know, back in the 1980s.
Okay. I'm talking about Stephanie Brown Trafton, who is like another Cal Poly Olympian.
Yeah. So like that event, it's really difficult to get a lot of points because they're based on what heptathletes are not going to throw the same as an open shot put.
So then does the shot put matter a little bit less then, right? I mean, in
to
relative...
To a point, but then if you are really good at the shot put, you can make up a lot of points there, and you can gain a lot there.
Right.
When historically most heptathletes aren't good, but if you are good, then you have an advantage there.
Yeah, is that something you've trained pretty hard in terms of shot put and
javelin? Definitely. Shot put is one of my, I'd say one of my best events in comparison to the field.
Okay.
It's still only worth like 900 to 950 points for me. Mm-hmm. And kind of 1,000 points is kind of the benchmark. If you can score
1,000 points
or
event.
More, that's really good.
Okay. And I talked to somebody and they were like, she's gotten really a lot better in like the strength and throwing events since college. That was like a comment somebody made when I was asking
about you.
Shot
put definitely has improved a lot. I think in college I threw like 39 feet.
Okay.
Or so, my first or second meet, and now I throw 52 feet.
Oh wow! Yeah.
So
that's a significant improvement for sure. Yeah, that's a testament to strength training and everything else.
Yeah.
And but the cool thing is, you know, being able to stay as fast and as limber
with
and
that.
Still,
definitely.
Because you can't lose the high jump, and you can't lose other things that are.
That's kind of the balance as a multi-event. You kind of have to find that where you can be fast and quick and light. Yeah. But then still throw like a shot putter.
Yeah. I'm also curious about coaching when you're a multi-event athlete. Like, do you have a shot put coach and a javelin coach and a jumping coach? Or do you have like three different coaches for different types of events? How does that work?
Not really. So Jack Hoyt is my coach, and he coaches me in every event. But there are times when I will work a little bit with the throws coach or work a little bit with a sprint coach.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I'm here in San Luis Obispo, I work a lot with Danny on long jump and hurdles.
On the ballistic events?
On the ballistic events, yes.
I was reading that and I was like, ballistic events? Do we have is this a biathlon maybe? Like, you know, are we cross country skiing and shooting? Like what's going on?
Explosive and sprint type events.
Okay.
But Jack knows all of the events, so he can coach me technically in all of those events as well.
So do you what's your relationship like with the current coaches, with the current do you train at Cal Poly from when you're
I
here?
Do anytime I'm in San Luis Obispo, which is probably like a third of the time, I train at Cal Poly, and sometimes with the team, or not necessarily with the team, but with the coaches, sometimes by myself or with other friends and stuff in the area. But I have a great relationship with them. They allow me access to the shed so I can still use all the equipment and blocks and all that kind of stuff to whatever I need to get done. And I work out in the weight room. So the strength coach there allows me to do that. So that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. He's gotten a lot of like write up lately, you know, Dr. Holder.
Yeah. He's a great strength coach.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear. I'm always interested to hear people's take on him.
He was my strength coach, I believe, my freshman, sophomore, and I think he may have left my junior
year.
Then
he left, right?
Yeah. He left.
San Jose?
He went to San Jose State and was up in the Bay Area for a while, and came back to San Luis Obispo a few years ago. Yeah. So I was really excited to see that he was back with Cal Poly and back in the Mustang family.
That's a good thing for Cal
really
Poly
awesome.
People have
it's
said.
It's a great thing, yeah. Because we went through a few strength coaches there that didn't really work out, as you can tell by the turnover in that position.
Sure. Well, it's hard too, right? I mean, you know, when you're at Cal Poly, I mean, I know they redid the weight room recently, but, you know, facilities wise, you know, you're still at Mott, you're still at you know, where you are. And so like to be able to attract a really good
high-level strength coach, you know, it can be tough. Yeah.
It's a big deal for the athletic department, though, if they can have a guy who, I mean, I've heard a ton of people just swear by it. Dr. Holder.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a great strength coach. I think he's done a great job with the athletic programs there, and hopefully he continues to do that for many years.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like you have a pretty strong relationship with Cal Poly athletic program.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Still. Yeah. Still very connected.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. That's good. I'm glad to hear that as somebody who went there. And I sometimes like wonder about, you know, like after people leave, what's the, you know, what happens?
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit easier for me because I do live here part time.
Right. Where else do you train?
At UCLA in Los Angeles. Okay. So that's kind of my primary training area during the season.
And that's where your coach is?
That's where my coach is. Jack Hoyt is the jumps and multis coach there.
So do you have a place? Like you live here, your husband's
here.
Yeah,
we have two. So we have a place down in LA and we have a place here in San Luis Obispo.
Yeah, you have to, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
how much I'm in both places, it's necessary.
Oh man, that's got to be kind of rough in terms of driving and stuff.
It can be, yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, traveling if you're an athlete, I guess, is
that's kind of part of the job. But yeah, it's tough to be away from my husband.
What is the season like, timing wise, when you're a professional?
So for track and field, indoor season starts in the winter, late December, January until March. And then from March until as late as September, mid-September is outdoor season.
And is it like one event a week, or have you a couple weeks that you're participating in?
It varies, but it can be up to one event a week, but usually once every 2 weeks or so.
Okay. And all over the world?
Yeah, mostly domestically, but definitely all over the world, especially in the summertime is more international travel and meets.
Yeah, what's the coolest city you've visited as a professional athlete?
The coolest city? Wow. That's tough. I've been to a lot of great cities.
And maybe you don't get to maybe you don't get to really see cities when you're
not
there.
Not all the time. We don't. I went to Rio in 2007 for the Pan American Games. That was pretty cool.
Was that like part of their whole warm up for the, you know, all the events that they've been holding in Brazil lately?
I think so. Yeah. I don't know if at that point they had been awarded the Olympics in 2007.
But maybe that's probably why they're like one of the reasons.
That might have been why they got the Olympics.
Like a showcase.
Because they, held
an
international event like that.
Right.
London is a great city. I love going to London.
Totally. And you're in the Olympics there?
Yes.
Okay.
In 2012.
Yeah.
And then Poland in 2014 was indoor world championships in Sopot. That was a pretty cool city, right on the water, pretty cool coastal town.
Okay. Okay. Cool. Poland. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the kind of random stuff I'm looking for. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And internationally, do people get like super pumped for track events? And,
oh
like,
my gosh.
It gets
so much.
Right. Right. I mean, in the U.S., you know, you probably like the NCAA national championships and like maybe the U.S. championships.
Yeah. The handful of large events. Yeah. Get a lot of attention.
Right.
But internationally, especially in Europe, track and field is huge, so any meet they have on a weekly basis, especially in the summer, there's a huge track and field European circuit. There's small meets that wouldn't even be recognized here in the States where the stands are packed and people are cheering. And the best thing about that, too, is they all are very educated in track and field, so they know your stats. They know what's good.
They're
and what's
keeping
bad
track of
and,
your of
oh,
what's...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't know what to cheer for. Oh, she threw it far, I think.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
She looked pretty fast. I don't know. Like, yeah, right? I mean, but they have a good picture for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, maybe, like, 20 years ago, the difference between, like, a U.S. fan watching a soccer match versus like an international fan watching a soccer match.
Definitely.
Like it's probably similar.
Exactly. Yeah.
To what that would be in terms of the nuances, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's see here. I wanted to ask you a little bit about how it's kind of like a lot of connections in your event, especially with Barbara Nwaba.
Yeah.
And you know, probably like your biggest competitor recently in
terms of
the U.S. crown. And her brother David plays basketball here. Like,
yeah.
Do you talk to David? Do you talk to Barbara?
I've seen him a few times around campus when I'm here in town. And then I remember one time he was like, "Wait, you're Sharon, right?" And we took a picture and he's like, "I'm going to send this to my sister."
got it.
That's pretty cool.
Were you and she, is she younger than you? Is she older
than
you? She
is.
Okay.
I think I was either, I might have been a senior when she was a freshman at Santa Barbara. Yeah,
and also like blue green, like it's like a Cal Poly UCSB rivalry thing. It's really cool. I got to say, like,
and
for the Big West, for the Central Coast, it's pretty rad.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I mean, I just think that's kind of a cool connection.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. You talk about training individually. There are other people, obviously, in your events. Like, how often do you see somebody like Barbara or other competitors? Are you friends with other track people, or is it like kind of a solitary deal? Like, do you train with a lot of other people at UCLA with your coach, or like, how does that all work?
So I train with the team mostly because I'm a volunteer assistant coach there.
At UCLA?
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
And then like this year we have a recent grad, Tatum Souza, who will be training post-collegiately with me and with the team. So
you're a volunteer assistant down there, which makes it so that you have, that's kind of who you're.
Yeah.
Who
so
your
I'm still
group
kind
is.
Of in the team atmosphere and it gives me access to UCLA's facilities.
Are most people who are like in track events, like do they do some coaching on the side in order to do that? Is that like a common deal?
It varies.
Kind of depends.
It depends if you're with, cause a lot of coaches are, you know, university and college coaches
because that's
how they make a living. But like for instance, Barbara's situation, she trains with a track club and her coach is like the head coach of the club. And so they're not as connected. I think they train with Westmont, but they're not as connected with the like university
down
system.
In Santa Barbara.
Yeah, right. Down in Santa Barbara.
Okay. Westmont's a nice campus.
It is a very nice campus, and they have a really nice track that was recently redone.
Oh, really?
Not too long ago. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And so they have a group of I think like 5 to 10 multi-event athletes, heptathletes, and decathletes who all train together, who are all professional post-collegiate.
Got it.
Athletes.
I know there's like a tradition in the heptathlon and so forth, and it being like different in terms of events than the decathlon. Like, what's in the decathlon that's not in the heptathlon?
So we don't pole vault. We don't throw the discus.
But women pole vault as an individual sport.
Yes, they do.
And women throw the discus as an individual sport.
Yes, they do.
So is the heptathlon inherently sexist?
I don't know if I'd say that. I think there may be certain people that are kind of holding it back from becoming a decathlon.
Okay.
Because there's been lots of debate last 15 to 20 years about switching it to the decathlon. And there's a lot of people that don't want it to be switched, who are coaches, who are athletes.
Like I said, you're talking to a guy who has no context or frame of reference. It's just like, I was like, oh, I mean, I could see why. I mean, it's, you know, women's tennis, they play 3 sets instead of 5 sets. Like, there's no reason for that at this point, I don't think.
No,
in my mind.
Exactly,
And so it's like the similar maybe kind of
And it's
of kind
of one
process.
Of those things where it's like it's been this way for so long now that maybe it should just be the same. Or
And that's women's,
that
I mean,
way.
Same with women's tennis, right? With
yeah,
the 3-set thing.
It's just
like,
kind of tradition in a way.
Right.
But I'm all for it becoming the decathlon, and I don't think there's any reason why it shouldn't be the decathlon. One of the arguments is that scheduling of meets would be more difficult because there would be a lot more overlap in the events and kind of the timing of when to start
a
hep and a dec and that kind of thing. Yeah. So they would have talked about changing the order of the events, but then the argument continues that would change the nature of the decathlon. And so there's a whole bunch of...
like if it doesn't happen in as close proximity, like, because in the decathlon, you got to go bang, 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 event after event
well,
for
that too,
however
but
many days.
All of the events are always contested in the same order, whether it be the heptathlon or decathlon.
Right.
So in the interest of, like, running a meet for both at the same time, it would be better to have, say, like, the first day events switch with the second day events for the women, But then that would change the nature of the event.
Right.
Because you do things in a different order.
And how can you compare, you know, Sharon Day Monroe with, you know, whoever did the event, you know, whoever did the heptathlon when the heptathlon was first around. And that those are the issues probably people have with it.
Yeah. So
interesting.
Well, I don't know if it will ever be changed, but I would be happy to do a decathlon.
Yeah. Okay. Definitely, you think you could throw a discus?
Oh yeah, yeah, for
it,
sure.
It wouldn't, you'd have enough energy for it. It wouldn't like,
I'd survive.
Yeah. You can handle it. I'm sure. What other sport are you the biggest fan of that's not a track sport?
Well, soccer. I'm a pretty big soccer fan, but I'd say probably basketball would be my next favorite sport.
Do you go to events at Cal Poly when you're around? Do you go to like soccer games?
Yeah, occasionally.
Basketball games?
I definitely try to get to a few soccer games every season when I'm here. Basketball's a little tougher because I'm not always here in the wintertime. But my husband's a huge basketball fan, so it's definitely a sport we watch together.
Got it. Of course, Elise Krehoff this year, or for the last 4 years, has been killing it in the Cal Poly soccer. Somebody told me your middle name, is it
Elise?
That is correct. Yeah. That's also kind of a random
little
thing.
Connection we have there.
Little tidbit that I got from somebody. And you know, you've been able to watch her and her performances over the past few years. She obviously, you used to be the fourth highest scorer in Cal Poly history.
She knocked me down, but I'm okay with that.
Yeah,
she's a great soccer player, and she just has a knack for finding the net, which I feel like sometimes that's something you can't really teach.
Right. You can be as fast as you want to be,
and
like as physically gifted as you want to be if you don't have touch and
If you can't read the field, then you don't have that instinct to just find the back of the net, which she has, which is awesome.
What kind of a soccer player were you? How would you describe your game?
Definitely speed was a big factor.
Sure.
Kind of the running
on,
gun.
On the wing?
Oh, yeah, in the wing or striker. Uh-huh. Scoring goals was my specialty.
Okay, yeah, sure.
But
poaching goals and getting some easy ones. That's good. Uh-huh. I like it. Do you have any pet peeves about like sports or athletes in general? Like things that people do that like that drive you nuts?
I really hate when people are cocky and when ego kind of trumps everything else. That's really a big pet peeve for me. So it's really hard for me to watch some of these athletes who think that when their head gets a little bit too big and they think they're all that, you know, in a bag of chips.
Do you ever watch like a high school game in San Luis County and go like, oh my gosh, is this happening right now?
Yeah, no, totally. At any level, I just think it's unacceptable. I think humility is really important, and to be humble and gracious as a champion is really important.
I never got into your actual schedule. So you're like in the off season right now, which means what, you have like a month or two where you're just probably like running 6 days a week or something. I don't know. But
kind of, yeah. So usually I take about a month off, which is usually September-ish, and then start training again. And when I start training, the first month to month and a half is a lot of just cross training and conditioning. And so, yeah, a lot of running workouts, a lot of cardio type stuff, and a little bit less technical work.
When you're at the height of your training, what's the schedule look like for a week? Like, is it crazy?
It can be. Yeah. I'd say the height of the training, like mid-season or toward late season, is a lot more technical work, but still kind of continuing to build the base of conditioning. We usually do 2 to 3 events per day. So we'll do
That was going to be one of my questions.
A jump and a sprint, or jump and a throw, and then some kind of running, whether it be working on sprint events or kind of 800 more like the distance.
Because those are kind of the three categories that you can kind of put things into.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of 2 to 3 of those a day for 6 days a week. And usually Wednesday is kind of like a recovery day. So we try to do like non-impact cardio to give the legs a little bit of a break.
So you train 7 days a week, but your break day? Oh,
no, I train 6 days a week, but Wednesday is usually active recovery or, you know, that kind of thing, non-impact.
And Sunday you take off.
And Sunday is usually off, depending.
Okay. So Monday, Tuesday, you go hard. Wednesday, you get a little break. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you're going
go hard again. Yeah.
Right. And then Sunday, you're totally off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a normal week.
How many hours a day?
A short day is 2 hours. Uh-huh. Long day, 6 or 7.
Right. Of just straight, like, just
at the track, training. In the weight room, all the stuff, all the everything.
And there's a level of, I think, you know, if you were like just a sprinter, you could get your sprint workout in.
Oh yeah, it'd be a lot shorter.
And any time of the day.
Yeah.
When you're a multi-sport, multi-event, what's the word?
Multi-event.
Sorry,
yeah.
Because.
Or combined events.
Because theoretically, like track and field is a sport, right? So like.
Yeah. So it wouldn't say a sport; it'd be event.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So multi-event athlete. You have to have it like planned out to the minute, to the second, like to the hour in terms of training, in terms of like when you're eating, when you're in the weight room.
Oh yeah,
like,
definitely.
There's just no time, I would imagine, some days like to.
Yeah,
to do
I definitely have lots of snacks and supplies with me at the track for long days at the track.
For sure. What's like a career usually? I mean, I know some track events, like there's women who run till they're 40 something. There's some in you know that you know like. Women's tennis for a long time, you know, people talk about, you know, mid-20s being like over the hill. Like I don't know where where like a multi-event
athlete.
Well,
it certainly depends on the event and track and field. I think multi-eventers typically are like early 30s is when people start to retire.
Okay.
And it just depends on, a lot of times I feel like that's as a result of injury. People start, the older you get, all the little things start piling up, and popping up. So if you can stay healthy, I don't see why anyone could stay, you know, till 35 or possibly, just depends on the person. But I think typically early 30s are kind of the cutoff.
So for you, like goal, like athletes. 4 or 5 more years would be like a good goal.
Right now,
like,
my goal is 2 more years.
2 more years. Okay.
Yeah. To train through 2017. 2018 is the off year cause there's no major championship that summer. So next summer, 2016 will be the Olympics.
Right.
2017 will be world championships.
Got it.
2018, there's no major championship. And then 2019 will be another world championships. 2020.
So 2016 is the Olympics.
Yep.
And where's that?
In Rio de Janeiro.
In Rio. Okay. And how does it work to get into the Olympics? Like, what's the qualifying? Is that something that's already happened?
So the Olympic trials are the beginning of July next summer.
Okay.
So just about a month before the Olympics.
So you've got your sights set there.
Definitely. And to qualify for the Olympics, you have to have the World A standard. Which is a standard set by the IAAF or the International Olympic Committee.
It's a number for the heptathlon.
Exactly. For every event, there's a mark, a number, whatever it may be for the particular events. You have to have that, and you also have to be top three at the Olympic trials.
Got it.
And if you're not top three, you have to be in the top three who have the Olympic A standard.
Okay, so there's like three wild cards internationally.
I understand
like,
what you mean.
So like if you were fourth in the U.S., but you're in the top three of all the people who didn't make it.
No. So say you're fourth in the U.S., but the person that got third place doesn't have the A standard.
Oh.
You would go instead of them. So you have to have the
A standard at some point during the year?
Yeah.
Okay,
so the qualifying window for the heptathlon.
So you don't have to get the A standard at the qualifier.
No.
You just
can
have
it going in. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I can picture that now. Sorry. Yeah. I was picturing, it's like, okay, the person who didn't make it from other countries.
Yeah. And every country has different qualification standards. The mark is the same for everyone, but depending on how they select those three athletes can vary from country to country.
So some countries can just say these three.
Exactly.
Like without having
a trials.
So it
can be very political in other countries where ours is very cut and dry. You have to go. Yeah, you got to go to the Olympic trials. You got to place top three.
Got it. And I'm picturing you. I'm picturing Barbara. I'm picturing maybe probably a couple up-and-comers who are gunning for that.
Yeah, there's actually, I think next year will be, especially for, I'd say, the third place spot, it's going to be a lot of competition. I'd like to think that Barbara and I have probably the best chance of making the team. And then there's probably like six other women who have a really good chance. Because there's a couple... probably three collegians right now who
are really good.
Yeah. And then a few other post-collegians as well.
Wow. So. Yeah, I'm just trying to contextualize like when I need to turn on the TV to check out and see when, you know.
Yeah, and I feel like in the Olympic year, the competition gets so good because everyone's trying to make the Olympic team.
And everybody's been like planning for it for four years.
Oh, definitely.
8 years,
exactly,
10 years.
Exactly.
Like, since they were,
so it's definitely, definitely a lot of competition.
Okay. And where are the Olympic trials this year?
At Eugene,
okay.
University of Oregon.
Yeah, they have a pretty good track program.
They
history
do.
Record.
Yep. Yeah. It's a great place to host a track meet. It's Tracktown USA. The fans there are great. I would definitely liken them to the European fans as far as track knowledge and you know, packing the stands and cheering. It's pretty fun to compete there.
So it's good. It's good for the sport to have it there.
And definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Last question. When you first came to SLO, or you know, you didn't know anything about it, like what were your impressions of San Luis as somebody from like, you know, this from, I know, you know, Orange County is not always like the city, but like for, as somebody who comes from, what they might deem civilization. Like yeah. I lived with three Orange County guys my first year of college, and they're like, "Are you serious? Like you're what? Like what are you talking about?" Some like the way I just looked at the world being from Cayugas, like,
yeah,
it was weird. So like, what struck you about SLO, or what struck you about Cal Poly when you?
Well, definitely the open space is a lot different, and kind of the sort of less planned communities. I feel like Orange County is very planned and laid out, and kind of that city and regional planning aspect of it. So the open space and kind of the outdoor culture, is what I definitely liked a lot coming here. It's a lot less crowded as well.
Yeah. Is that like I guess that's a benefit or something that's attractive about this area?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Like you, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And I know there's other past Olympians who are around. I know I hear one on the radio sometimes, like Paul Tarek.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure.
So I always like pictured him like a little bit older than he is. Like when I heard him on the radio for some reason,
yeah.
I'm like, dude, this guy's like young and fit and like looks like he could go there right now and like kick some ass. I don't know. Anyway, very cool. Very cool. Well, I really appreciate you coming on, and best of luck moving forward here.
Thank you very much.
Start training again.
I'm actually in my fourth week of training.
Fourth week right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
So pretty much October I started training again.
How are you feeling?
Feeling good, actually. I think my speed endurance is really good right now. So did a tough workout today that I crushed. So I was happy about that.
Nice. Yeah, it feels good.
So
probably.
I'm feeling good, yeah.
Yeah, I just like the self-motivation for those, like, okay, this is a workout I'm going to do and this is what I'm going to get. And like, it takes a kind of a person to be able to do that.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
I'm not that kind of a person, but like, but I respect it so much.
Yeah, it definitely is easier when there's people to run with, but sometimes when it's not, it can be a little bit more difficult.
People there to like motivate. And like just like
yeah exactly
you can tell them what your goals are and then like you feel like you're held accountable kind of
thing.
Well, really good luck. I really appreciate you coming on. Congratulations. Cal Poly Hall of Famer.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, like before we go, I gotta talk about the Hall of Fame. You got your name on a plaque in the hallway there now, and and what's that like? I mean, I'm sure when you walked through there, you're like, oh man, who are these all these old guys who are in there? And now you're like in your prime as an athlete, and they, you know, they throw you in the Hall of Fame, which is totally deserved, by the way. But what's that like?
It feels pretty good. Yeah. It's a huge honor, and you know, I'm pretty humbled by it. And just to be inducted so young feels really incredible.
Yeah. I mean, did you get a chance to talk to any of the other Hall of Famers during that weekend?
Like, oh, yeah.
How
definitely.
Much did you guys hang out? I mean, people like Damone Johnson. My father worked at the the meal hall, like the dining hall back in the day. And like when I was real little, he worked at the meal hall there. And he used to always tell me about DJ. And like we'd watch him on TV and he was on the Rams. Oh, you went to Cal Poly. You used to come in and eat at my place or whatever. And it was like, okay, this is cool. But
yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. What kind of stories did those guys have to tell, like, or conversations? Like?
It was pretty amazing just seeing the kind of the age difference in all of the Hall of Famers, from like Lisa and I, who are barely 30 years old, to some of these guys who, I think there was one swimmer who he had to, I don't know how old he was, but he's up there. And so to hear kind of his stories about his time at Cal Poly was pretty amazing. Just seeing like kind of the Cal Poly greatness from so long ago until now is pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool when you just hear stuff getting read off. I mean, like, I think him, like,
all
you
the
know,
stats.
Yeah, all the stats. And I mean, you know,
all the records. And yeah, it's pretty cool.
Well, yours was the longest, I think, probably. It was like, okay. And like, I think Moreno took a breath, the PA guy. And then she played soccer too, and so on and so forth. So again, I really appreciate it, Sharon. Thanks again for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Good luck. Good luck this season.
Thank you.
All right.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Fansmanship Podcast. For more podcasts and more in-depth sports discussion, go to fansmanship.com.
Well, I've been stuck on down in Trouble Town. It's a lonely place, it's true. Streetlights so bright, they blind my vision.
And the people on the streets, they beat me up till I'm black and blue.